Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Dr. Carla Hayden joins me for her first interview since being confirmed by the Senate as the next Librarian of Congress. After 23 years in what many people consider a transformative tenure as the director of Baltimore's Enoch Pratt Free Library, next month, Dr. Hayden will become the first woman and the first African-American to hold the most high-profile library post in the nation. Then, producer Bridget Armstrong visits the Reginald F. Lewis Museum's latest exhibition. It's called Now That's Cool, and it features rare artifacts like an original picture of Frederick Douglass from a decidedly not-so-cool era. Plus, historian Lawrence Jackson on The City That Bleeds. He wrote a provocative essay in last month's Harper's Magazine on Freddie Gray and the legacy of inequality that seeded last year's uprising. J. Wynn Russick has her weekly theater review first, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1 WYPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Very pleased to be joined in the studio by our good friend, Dr. Carla Hayden. She was the director of the Enoch Pratt Free Library for 23 years. Her last day in that position was on Friday. Last February, President Obama nominated her to be the next Librarian of Congress. And last month, the Senate confirmed her historic nomination. When she begins her tenure early next month, she will become the nation's first woman and the first African-American to head the Library of Congress. And it is great to see you. Congratulations, Carla
Hayden.
Thank
you so much. It's been wonderful to be with you over the years as well and share books and thoughts about reading and everything. So it's wonderful to be here again.
Well, it's terrific that you're going to start this next new exciting chapter. As you look at this, you know, vast expanse, this collection, the Library of Congress, what are your priorities? What do you think you want to, you know, sort of tackle in your first and early part of your tenure?
Well, one of the first things, of course, would be to make sure that the staff of the Library of Congress and the people who have worked so hard for so many years, and you've had experience, like, for instance, the music department. There's so many people that have made it into the treasure it is, to go on a listening tour and hear their ideas and to really get a sense of the direction that we could all go in with technology and the impact of technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of folks sort of think of the Library of Congress as an abstraction, but it is a real library. I mean, when I was a music scholar, I mean, I got a doctorate in music and I wrote a dissertation and I spent a lot of time in the music room, in the music department of the Library of Congress. They're incredibly erudite. They're very helpful. For example, every single doctoral dissertation, including, I guess, yours and mine, are on file, you know, in a hard copy at the Library of Congress. But people do use this. I mean, scholars use this from all over the world, and Congress itself uses it. I mean, this is a working building. It's not just a symbolic place, isn't it?
And I think that's one of the things that surprised me the most is when I talk about the Library of Congress and I've been in this process, people are not as aware that they can go into the Jefferson Building and see the magnificent facility, and also that they can actually use the materials. And you don't have to be a scholar, but you could be a person who's interested in all types of things. And the treasures that they have are just incredible.
And when you talk about digital technology and you start dealing with that new frontier, I mean, you've got companies like Google wanting to digitize every book ever written by any human. How does that, you know, feed into the work that the library can do? I mean, do you expect that there'll be just much more of the collection available digitally?
Definitely. And I think that there will be much more of the collection that people will be aware that is already digitized. For instance, George Washington's papers. People might not realize that the first 23 presidents, their papers are contained in their collection at the Library of Congress. And so they have, for instance, the inaugural addresses of all of the first 23 presidents right there with some of their inscriptions or their changes.
The marginalia, as we call it.
To display during this wonderful time in the country. So part of the technology and the digitization effort will be to make sure that those collections are not only available online, but that people know about them.
Sure. On 88.1, It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Carla Hayden, who has recently retired as the director of the Enoch Pratt Library. She becomes the next Librarian of Congress next month. The historic nature of your appointment, the first African-American, first woman to lead this enormous enterprise, what's that mean to you?
As a librarian, and I am a career librarian, it's especially significant in terms of being a woman, because librarianship is one of the four, what they typically call, feminized professions: social work, education, nursing, and librarianship. And so having a woman be the Librarian of Congress is especially significant for the profession. And then, of course, being African American is just a double part of it. And so it really is something.
You were named last spring by Fortune magazine as one of the 50 of the world's great leaders. I mean, you have been roundly applauded for the work that you've done here at the Pratt over these last, almost 2.5 decades. What's your advice for your successor? There's a search committee underway, working to find somebody to fill your very big shoes. What do you want to tell him or her?
Enjoy the fact that Baltimore is a city, and I'm staying here. I'm still living here, and my mother's here. This is home. That Baltimore is a city that has a unique relationship with its public library. The Enoch Pratt Free Library is beloved by generations, and so you have a library that has a wonderful reputation professionally, but also in the neighborhoods and the communities of Baltimore. And so many people want to see the Pratt Library succeed and continue to thrive, and that's what's kept me here for so long, and it really is a wonderful opportunity.
How are things going with the renovation and restoration of the Central Library down there on Cathedral Street?
The renovation has started. If you pass by Cathedral Street and Park Avenue, you'll see scaffolding going on. The library's open. And you will also see wonderful things in some of the neighborhood libraries, too.
In your position as the most highest profile librarian in the country, do you have an obligation, or is it part of your purview, to have relationships with community libraries around the country?
One of the first things that I think will be on the schedule in September would be for me to attend the opening of a branch library at the Washington, D.C. Public Library in a neighborhood. They've already requested that, so that there is that relationship that we hope to build with all types of libraries, small college libraries, rural libraries, all types of libraries, and people could feel that this is their library, too.
Your process of confirmation took a long time. It's not unusual. In February, you were nominated, and then, it wasn't until this summer that it became a done deal. When people think about public service, when they're asked to, leave the current positions that they're in to come work for the federal government, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, it took so many months, and a lot of hurry up and wait. But what has that confirmation process been like for you?
It has been an affirmation of the fact that when you are asked to serve, and I was actually asked, would you serve as the next Librarian of Congress? You really are being part of a general effort to help the nation. And even though I'm not in the armed forces and haven't had that opportunity, there is that sense that this is not unusual that you're asked to have challenges, and that it's actually a privilege that you can do it. So I'm glad that I got a chance to serve.
And your position required Senate confirmation. So you had a Senate committee that you appeared before, and that seemed to go quite well. And Senator Blunt from Missouri
was just
a Republican, right,
in terms of his fairness and really looking at the issues. And I can't thank him enough for that.
Yeah. And of course, you had, before you came to Baltimore, you were in Chicago. And when you're in Chicago, I guess you knew the Obamas, both Mr. and Mrs. Obama, in some capacity. What was your relationship with them before you came to Baltimore? And obviously, that was one of the things that, you know, obviously influenced Mr. Obama's decision to nominate you. You were a known quantity to him, at least.
Actually, the nomination was more of a result of the library profession.
Because you had been the president of the American Library Association.
Right.
You've held national positions before. Right.
The profession really supported my nomination, and even before I was nominated, indicated that I might be one of the librarians that they would support. And so it was very interesting to have that almost synergy of actually having some knowledge of the president and the first lady from my time in Chicago, and this professional aspect coming together. And so it was quite something to think about that 20-something years ago when you worked in Chicago and knew them, that here 20-something years forward, you would be president and a librarian.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you are not the first, but you're one of very few, just maybe one or two, I guess, people as the Librarian of Congress who's an actual librarian.
Right. I mean,
most people have not been
in the third.
The third, yeah. What does that mean? I mean, what do you think your knowledge and your great expertise in the field of library sciences, how will that particularly inform what you're going to be doing?
As the 14th Librarian of Congress, I think my administrative experience and managerial experience and, of course, library experience will be very helpful as the library moves into another phase. The scholars that have been the heads of the Library of Congress really put the spotlight on that scholarship and the significance of the collections. And so each librarian brings something else to the evolution of the Library of Congress. So I think my aspect will be more of public access, letting everyone know about the collections, and then also managing.
Well, Carl Hayden, we will miss you at the Pratt. Thank you for the phenomenal job you've done there. And just best of luck to you. We're so excited
that you're
going to be able to
start. Please have me back.
We will indeed. Indeed. Dr. Carla Hayden, she will become the next Librarian of Congress next month. The search is underway for her successor at the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Coming up after a break for the news, this is cool. No, really, this is cool. That's the name of the current exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture, and producer Bridget Armstrong will give us a tour. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. Now, producer Bridget Armstrong reports on the latest exhibition at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. It features rare artifacts from a painful time in Maryland's history.
The Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture's latest exhibition is called Now That's Cool. The collection tells the story of the long and varied African American experience in Maryland, a story that for many decades was defined by slavery, segregation, and the legacies of those institutions. Cool may not be the word that comes to mind when you think about objects that were often used to subjugate Black people, But Lewis Museum curator Charles Buffet says there is rhyme and reason behind the title.
I was introduced to museums at a very, very early age, like, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old. And I was always in awe of the power of a museum and the power of the artifacts and the stories and the interpretive things around those stories. And I've always thought those things were cool. Have you ever been in a museum and you saw an artifact or you heard the story behind the object and thought to yourself, that's cool? Well, that's what this entire exhibition is designed to do. Even though we're talking about some very, very hard-hitting subject matters as far as segregation or slavery or what have you, the reality of a museum to be able to preserve and have those things to teach and tell to other, you know, next generations is rather cool.
The 40-plus items in the exhibit were donated and collected over the past 10 years, but they even donated a few special pieces of his own.
I was introduced to Frederick Douglass at an early age, and he became a hero of a sense of mine. And as I got older, I started to delve into anything that I could get my hands on that related to Frederick Douglass. I had a copy of his original narrative, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, where he spoke of having the opportunity to learn to read in a very secretive manner. He would carry a copy of Webster's spelling book that he would trick some of his other white playmates to teach him various lessons out of that book. Later on, he would write in his autobiography about how another book really changed his life, and that was The Columbian Orator. Now, I had an opportunity to seek out and acquire both of those titles in my own personal library. And when I got here at the museum and started to work on this exhibition, I decided to gift my copies of those particular volumes to the institution. And they're dated at the time period that they very well could have been of the time set and years that Frederick Douglass would have been able to utilize. And that's the Columbian Orator of 1817 and Webster's Speller, also of 1817. One of the other things that I wanted to bring to your attention are the two original photographs of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass being a Marylander and one of our native sons here in the state. These were the first original photographs that were a part of the museum's collection that I brought in early in my tenure. And these two particular cartavies, one from 1889 when he was an older gentleman and one from 1864. Now the interesting thing about this, Frederick Douglass was the most photographed person in the country in the 19th century. Century, both black or white. And there is a number of reasons for that. One, he personally was very intrigued with the process of photography as an art form, posing for daguerreotypes and ambiguotypes, as well as tintypes and even the cartavies, was something that he was interested in. So every place that he visited throughout the country, he would try to seek out a local photography shop and sit for said photographer. So these two are original, as I indicated, and are new to the collection.
An old door from the segregated days of Baltimore's Druid Hill Park was donated after city employees discovered the words white men written under a panel in several layers of paint.
Druid Hill Park was established in the mid-1800s, and it was developed as a recreational area for families of the city of Baltimore to come and recreate in an urban environment. Well, a day at the park meant something different for African-American families because Druid Hill Park became a segregated facility. And this particular door is a reminder of that level of segregation during the Jim Crow era of segregation throughout the country. Now, this particular door comes from the bathhouse of the white pool area where whites could utilize that particular facility. And it wasn't until later on where there was a secondary pool that was built that was specifically for African Americans.
I admit, there was something cool about standing in front of this rather large and imposing door, knowing that it was a relic from before my time. But other pieces in the collection inspired feelings of disgust and anger.
There is one piece in this exhibition that is a deposition from a person who purchased a slave, and that slave died soon after the purchase. And he was upset, and he wanted to sue the slave dealers who sold him what he considered in that deposition faulty property. So what the label reads, imagine, if you will, you bought a brand new television and you went out, you got it home, took it out the box, you plugged it up, it worked for a little while, then it stopped working. How would you feel about that? Would you take it back to the store, demand your money back? Would you, at no fault of your own, argue the fact that you received the faulty property? Now, imagine for a second, if it wasn't a television, it was an actual human being. Where does that put it into various perspectives? And it's written in that way not to belittle the life of that person that we're talking about, that enslaved person, but to put it into context of what we're talking about here as far as property. Younger folks don't really get or understand when you say you owned someone. You're talking about another human being that had fears, that had thoughts, that wanted to love, that had joys, that had sadness, and you own them to the point where you're controlling them, more like not even necessarily livestock, but literally a piece of furniture to do what you ever desired.
There's a broadside, a type of ad that's basically a poster with words, soliciting help in the capture of two slaves in Frederick, Maryland in 1802.
This particular broadside is advertising a reward given of $40 for two individuals, one by the name of Negro Harry and the other by Negro Len. Now, Harry and Len were the property of the Johnson brothers, four brothers who ran or the proprietors of the Catoctin Furnace out in Frederick, Maryland. And at some point in time, Harry and Len escaped from the furnace. And this broadside was put in place to advertise their capture. It also allowed people who were not specifically looking for Harry and Lynn the opportunity to kidnap or capture other persons of color to sell into slavery, because that's what people did to, you know, augment their income in other ways. The other interesting thing about this particular piece is one of those four brothers, Thomas Johnson, went on to serve as Maryland's first governor. The description that I'm reading now is a brief description of what Negro Harry looked like as it reads in the broadside. And he is listed as being a short, well-set little fellow of a yellowish complexion, and he wears his wool combed, that wool being his hair, and has a large sear in his forehead. He is a cooper by trade and plays on the fiddle. He is sensible and talkative and has waited, when young, in the house. He is now nearly 30 years old. He is the property of James Johnson, who cannot describe his clothes.
Like, how can you just hunt an average human being down like he was an animal?
That's Jaquez Richardson. He's a student at Friendship Academy. This summer, he's working at Boone Street Farm. He visited the museum with other students in the farm's youth program.
And it's not that they escaped because they did something bad. They escaped because they was being held against their will. Like, they escaped because they didn't want to be shackled and forced to do stuff anymore.
As it was for Jaquez, seeing the broadside was especially gripping for several of the museum visitors I spoke with. Amasita was in town from London visiting family on her first trip to the U.S. She said as a Black British woman, she wanted to know more about African American history.
Reading about the broadside advertising, it was quite sad to read about it, just the extent to which slave owners went to recapture slaves, the effort, the time, the tenacity, the determination. I just think it just shows just how committed they were to perpetuating this torturous life for Africans. I mean, they saw it as business and they see it as money, so it's probably, you know, like runaway money, but these were lives, human lives.
I am very in touch with my ancestors, so I feel like their pain is my pain. Anytime I think about what happened to them or I talk about what happened to them, I become emotional because that's me. That is my family that this happened to. These are my people that this happened to. So I'm not disconnected from the experience at all, even though I did not go through it.
Nicole Nance is a site director for the after-school program at William Packer Elementary. She brought a group of students ranging from kindergarten to fifth grade to the museum. Nicole says that even though the kids in her program are young, they're never too young to start learning about their history.
We have 72 students with us today, and we have 7 youth workers. I am an advocate for our children learning their history as early as possible. In the morning, we had a discussion about where we were coming, and I asked a question. I said, you know, what is a slave? What is slavery? a lot of it is brand new information to them. So I honestly had to start from the beginning. I had to tell them the truth. I had to tell them that we were stolen from Africa. I actually had a few students just to give them a concept of slave ships, just to have them lay down close to each other, right on top of each other. And I explained the slave trade. I explained everything from them being captured to them getting to America to them building America.
Visitor Services Guide Amber Merritt, who we just heard leading the kids in song, says she's witnessed the museum's ability to help young people understand slavery and racism.
So the group that came in, it was actually a mix of students, mainly African-American. A couple of Caucasian children came in as well. And when I told them about Harriet Tubman's sisters being sold away to different plantations, what she was asking me, she was like, well, why were African-Americans being sold? Why was this happening? And it was great for me to see a little child being so empathetic towards our situation. And I told her that at the time, you know, African Americans were seen as property. We weren't seen as people who had so much knowledge and who had so much things to share. So going from there, I just really felt like this little girl, with her being so inquisitive about what was happening with us, that if we just keep answering every little question that these children have early, so that we can teach them that being African American is a great thing, being any race is a great thing, because we all come with different cultural backgrounds, we all bring different things to any situation. So it's just great to see that.
Museum curator Charles Bethay says he knows that some people will be resistant to the latest exhibition because they don't want to be reminded of the despair and ugliness of slavery and segregation. But he hopes people will understand why it is imperative that we remember and preserve the relics of the past.
When you hear naysayers talk about, well, we're tired of hearing about slavery and we're past that, or you hear people from the other side of the aisle saying, hey, I didn't own slaves, why am I being forced to relive and rethink these things? Well, we all know everything that we do is based on a level of intelligence, so people have some element of critical thinking as to how they relate and respond to things. And if we keep in the forefront some elements of our collective history, because slavery was not just a black thing, slavery was not just a white thing, it was an American thing, specifically to this country, so it involves all of us. And if you keep that in the forefront, you would allow people to take what they want from it and add it to their own lives and add it to their own understandings of what is going on and how it relates to things today.
Now That's Cool will be on display at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture until December 31st. For more information about the museum and the exhibit, visit us on the web at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Reporting for Maryland Morning, I'm Bridget Armstrong. More to come. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. For this week's theater review, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has gone rustic. She's ventured to the meadow adjacent to the Evergreen House in North Baltimore to catch the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Julius Caesar.
There are two striking non-traditional elements in the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Julius Caesar. First, it's set at the time of the American Revolution. And second, although almost all of the characters are men, women play more than half the roles. The reason for the changed time period, to paraphrase director Chris Cotterman's program notes, is that the story of Julius Caesar was distant but relatable history to Shakespeare's original audiences. So why not create a similar link, okay, not quite as distant, that would resonate with American audiences? Baltimore Shakespeare Factory is dedicated to, quote, recreating the experience that Shakespeare's audiences would have had. I can't say how relevant his audiences might have found the hubris of the title character, the presumptive king, but I suspect it might touch a chord with audiences here. Having women play a number of male roles, as men, is nothing new for the Shakespeare Factory. But unlike last summer's all-female Henry IV, in this case the casting appears to be more gender-blind than an effort at a political statement. Anne Shoemaker plays Caesar, at least initially, as a fairly reasonable leader. But as we hear in Caesar's final long speech before his death, his self-aggrandizement builds.
The skies are painted with unnumbered sparks. They are all fire, and every one doth shine. But there's but one in all doth hold his place. So in the world 'tis furnished well with men, and men are flesh and blood and apprehensive. Yet in the number I do know but one, that unassailable holds on his rank, unshaked of motion. And that I am he.
Almost from the start, Shannon Ziegler's Brutus is unusually calculating and angry, in all but his tender scenes with his young servant, Lucius. In the assassination scene, Ziegler's Brutus doesn't just deliver the final blow, he stands face to face with Caesar, then slits his throat. Caesar initially defends himself with sword and dagger, though I'm not sure how he remains standing after being repeatedly stabbed. The fight choreography is by Tegan Williams. In the meadow at Hopkins Evergreen Museum and Library, where this production began its run, Ziegler stood on a hillock to deliver Brutus's post-assassination speech to the populace. The theatergoers become the populace, and Cotterman's direction reinforces this by having some of the actors stand and respond in the audience. The tactic becomes increasingly effective when Fred Fletcher Jackson, as a shrewd Antony, takes Brutus's place and delivers Antony's famed funeral oration.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar.
Fletcher Jackson is a stalwart, determined Antony, a true friend of Caesar's, although he too becomes a bit taken with his own power. Many of these subtleties were difficult to appreciate in the outdoor evergreen setting, where actors who are not mic'd often fought a losing battle with noisy choruses of crickets and overhead airplanes. When the actors spoke with their backs to the audience, the situation got even worse. These problems presumably will decrease this weekend when the production moves indoors to the company's permanent home at St. Mary's Community Center in Hamden. Julius Caesar is one of the most frequently taught Shakespeare plays, but it's not one of the most frequently produced. The last production I saw was also in an election year, 2004. The Shakespeare Factory's Julius Caesar isn't the most polished I've seen, but 12 years later, the themes of battling for power, baiting the citizenry, and recognizing an honorable leader are once again timely, thought-provoking, and American.
The Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Julius Caesar continues Friday through Sunday indoors at St. Mary's Community Center in Hamden and outdoors at the beautiful Bourdie Vineyards in Baltimore County. We've got a link to all the details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. J. Wynn Russick will be back again next week with a review of Hand to God at the Studio Theater in Washington. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to take a quick break for news, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Lawrence Jackson. He's written an interesting essay in Harper's Magazine reflecting on Freddie Gray and the causes of the riots and uprising last year. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The anniversary of Freddie Gray's death and the violence and uprising that followed have come and gone. The trials of the six police officers indicted in connection with his death have ended without a single conviction. In the July issue of Harper's Magazine, Dr. Lawrence Jackson,
who's been a professor of African American Studies and English at Emory University, reflected on his hometown, Baltimore, and the decades of policies and practices that preceded and seeded the riots and uprising last year. The title of his article invokes a phrase that's familiar to anyone who's been in Charm City for a while. It's called The City That Bleeds. Lawrence Jackson joins me in the studio. Welcome home.
Thank you so very much for having me.
So you've been at Emory University for the past several years, but you are, in fact, on your way home, going to be at Hopkins this coming school year.
I'm very excited to be joining the faculty there.
Yeah. So you start the article with your impressions of the trial of Officer William Porter, the first trial that occurred before the first of the year. It ended in December. And it turns out that you knew some of the people in that courtroom. Others have noted that William Porter and Freddie Gray grew up just a couple of blocks from each other. They were contemporaries. When you came home and you sat in that courtroom, what did you see and what did it bring to mind?
Well, it was pretty remarkable. I mean, again, from the outside or outside of Baltimore, I'm living in Atlanta, Georgia. I've been there since 2002. You know, you sort of anticipated a huge crowd or what have you. And I remarked that the first couple of days of the trial, the Porter trial, the largest groups were students from, I think, Park School and a couple of other local high schools. Maybe City College also had groups of students there. And then once they cleared out, you know, sort of after lunch, I mean, it was a really, you know, more journalists than the public. And I wound up about 2:30 sitting behind Freddie Gray's family. I didn't recognize them or know them, but, you know, you could sort of see the intense emotion that was passing through a group of people. And after a little while, they were joined by another relative who sat beside me. And he was sort of, you know, having a little bit of a conversation with them. And the judge, Barry Williams, had, of course, barred, you know, sort of any speaking. And after a while, sheriff's deputies removed the gentleman. And it was
an uncle of Mr. Gray.
Apparently so. Yes, sir. You know, it was just really a very poignant kind of scene because I've always been dismayed, perhaps, that African-Americans, their jury service, our jury service, has been slighted, you know, as if we're somehow particularly subjective jurors or incompetent in cases involving elements of race in American criminal justice system. I thought that, you know, this was one time where you actually had, you know, sort of black people with a deep investment in the outcome of the trial. So I was sort of, you know, moved by the situation of the man being removed and also perhaps being drawn into the theater there myself and, you know, was very much prepared to put the sheriff's deputies in the role of the villain. And as I was leaving the courtroom, I realized that I knew several of the sheriff's deputies, and not just casually, but that they were actually people I'd gone to elementary school with, junior high school with, played in the band with, gone to church with. And actually people who I had a really close and important connection to. And that drove home for me that there wasn't a great deal of distance between Freddie Gray and William Porter, and I imagine also Cesar Goodson. And, you know, I've been thinking about the guys that I grew up with, the people in my neighborhood, people that I knew who lost their lives in police custody or in encounters with the police, and it definitely was an occasion for not just soul searching, but also deep melancholy and sadness.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Lawrence Jackson, currently on the faculty of Emory University and about to join the faculty of Johns Hopkins University. He's written an article in Harper's Magazine called "The City That Bleeds." Interesting that you know folks on all sides of the ledger here.
Sure.
You in your article in Harper's, you talk about how what happened in April of 2015 was a genuine uprising. Mm. What do you mean by that?
I suppose having maybe some slight familiarity with the corner, maybe just in passing of Pennsylvania North Avenue, I went to church at Lafayette and Arlington Avenue, and then I grew up on the north side of Mondawmin Mall.
I live five blocks from Penn and North, so I know what you're talking about. Many of our listeners do, too.
Okay, we go through the corridor. But from the time I was about 14 years old or so, maybe even younger than that. I mean, I always wondered why there wasn't an ongoing riot there at Penn North. And, you know, obviously I'm a professional academic. I'm supposed to have either a historical long view or some solutions handy. But you talk to young people and they say, well, the day of the riot, that was the day of widespread communal feeling. That's when people stopped their cars and asked, you know, are you all right? Do you have something to eat? Did you get something from, you know, one of these places? Can we give you a lift somewhere? That's extraordinary. And it's very important when we can identify moments when, you know, sort of the social fabric is so torn that this is an example of, you know, sort of group belonging. I think that instead of vilifying young people, trying to make examples of them, you know, looking for scapegoats, bandying around the term about the thugs or the hoodlums and so on and so forth, that we would do better now to redouble our efforts to try to see if we can rescue a generation or participate fully in the lives of a generation of people who could be, you know, some of the state's best citizens, the most dynamic citizens, the people who are coming up with creative solutions for problems that are not just specific to West Baltimore or Penn North, but I mean to the globe.
You didn't quote who it was, but you said someone somewhere figured out that the investment in a place like Camden Yards
is 1%.
You generated 1%. Right, that may or may not be true. I don't know, but let's say it is true. Let's assume that it is, right? Is that a bad deal? Because you've got you haven't lost money on this thing. You've made a little profit, and you've got this thing that brings people together. Ostensibly, brings Black, White, Korean, Hispanic together. You know, around you know, excitement about the Orioles and stuff. I mean, the cities talk about the city leadership, both Black and White city leadership across the country talks about that dimension of morale and that dimension of you know, city pride. So, because it shouldn't be an either-or thing. It shouldn't be, oh, we're going to invest in Camden Yards, which means we're not going to invest on West North Avenue.
Yeah, I just would be a strong detractor against spectacle sports and the construction of the mega stadiums and the mega athletic spectacles. I mean, baseball arguably is a little bit different, but then baseball also has in the modern era, or certainly for the last 25 years, I mean, they have sort of such poor racial politics. I mean, you know, it has become the lily white sport. I mean, almost
certainly is in the stands.
Yeah,
you know, well, and on the field too. No, but in the stands, it certainly is. Yeah.
All of them in the stands, you know, really do wind up reflecting who can afford to go. But other kinds of investments, I think, would make more sense and would help again the citizens of Baltimore.
All right. Well, Lawrence Jackson, great to meet you and welcome back home. Glad you're going to be at Hopkins and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Lawrence Jackson, he's about to join the faculty of Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore after several years teaching at Emory University in Atlanta. His essay about Baltimore appeared in the July issue of Harper's Magazine. We've got a link to the piece on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Wednesday, a reporter's notebook on the complex dynamics of the Port Covington Project with Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal and Natalie Sherman of the Baltimore Sun. Till then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.